I was watching these clips last night of you on the road with Bob Seger.
I was a little offended because I thought the shit I was doing was pretty fucking cool.
When I interviewed Dan Huff, he shouted you out about a session. When you played Need You Now, did they ask for that slide part that you played?
No. Okay, well,
how'd you get into the Luke Combs camp? Today's episode is sponsored by Gator Cases. Guitarists, like any other musician, value the advantages of proper protection for their gear. Guitars, amps, effects, and accessories all need safe transport and storage. Luckily, Gator's got you covered. Three-time ACM Guitar Player of the Year, Rob McNally. Is it four times?
It is now.
Didn't they change the category? Or what happened?
No, I don't think they changed the category, but
I screwed up this early on.
That's okay, man. It doesn't really matter.
No, it matters, Rob. It matters. What is it?
I'm the current ACM guitar player.
Yes, I think so.
I think so. Okay. Yeah. So you can win and then you can't win the next year. So it's like it takes a long time to. I've been doing this a long time.
Why did they do that? Shouldn't you be able to just win every year? What's the point?
Here's the deal. Like, think back into the 90s. The same guys were winning it every single year.
That's why they put that rule in.
And I think Eddie Bears, I've heard from older players that Eddie Bears was won like something ridiculous, like 18 years in a row, and he finally went into him and said, "Hey, there's a lot of great guys here doing great things, doing a bunch of records. We should, you know, you should be disqualified the next
year." But it took him 18 years to say that. That sounds like a lot of winning to get to that point,
so
Eddie.
Much
but
winning.
We'll take it. That was very generous. Yeah. Does that mean anything? What does that mean to you? Is that really meaningful, or is that kind of not, you know, I don't know.
Well, it's incredibly meaningful because your community recognizes you in some way. So that's always great, you know, but I don't really think about it too often because the first time I won it, first of all, I didn't even know there was a such thing as an award until I started getting nominated. I started getting texts like, "Congratulations." I was like, "What's this even about?" Because I never, that's not on my radar that you can be a guitar player and win an award for that.
For being the best guitar player.
Well, you're not, that is not what I think it means. Well, I think it has more to do with, like, if you played on a bunch of big records that year that made an impact to the board of that organization, then that's kind of what it means. Because, I mean, we're in Nashville. I mean, I'm confident about what I do, but, I mean, come on, who's the best? I mean, there is no best. It's like everybody's so good with different skill sets or whatever. I don't know. I just don't think about it that much. But it is nice to get a nod once in a while.
Quick note, if you want to check out some of the licks that Rob is playing in this interview, you can get all of that plus a bunch of other great guitar lessons on my Patreon. Everything's tabbed out. Check it out. Link in the pinned comment. All right, back to the interview.
Balance, when you were learning guitar, you have so much range as a session musician. Mm. Did you acquire that knowledge all at once by constantly bouncing between different topics? Or did you spend a chunk of your life focusing on one style and then another technique and then something else and going through it like that? How do you develop range on the guitar?
I think it's more to do with your record collection. Like, how much different stuff do you listen to? I mean, you know, I think most musicians are this way. When they're out and about, you hear popular music that maybe you don't listen to at home. And if you're paying attention, you hear what sounds those records make or whatever, you know. And I think a lot of musicians, your antenna is always up if you're paying attention. I don't know. I think it does come over a long period of time. I was pretty old when I started getting into sessions compared to other people. I was well into my 30s. So, I mean, that's a lifetime of listening to a lot of different music and having a ton of different gigs. I mean, all the top 40 gigs that I had to have up in Columbus, Ohio before I moved here, learning songs I would never really seek out to learn. And then just, you know, I would say that the music that I dove into the most was kind of like old blues and soul music and all of that. And maybe that gives me a different kind of angle towards things that isn't usual.
Did you spend like a chunk of time though figuring out how to play like Hendrix rhythm or some other style, or do you just sort of figure that out on the job and all of a sudden a song requires that thing and you pull it out and you make it work?
Yeah, well, I think all of us probably draw some from our heroes. I obviously went through a Hendrix period once I found out who he was, pretty young though. I mean, probably like 14, 15, something like that. I spent time digesting all the things that I liked and just, I mean, you know, hanging out on a Friday or Saturday night instead of partying, I was sitting in front of a record player and figuring it out.
Yeah, right, right.
You know,
when I interviewed Dan Huff, he shouted you out about a session where I think it was maybe the first session you ever did with him.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he said it was a Beatles session. And I think he said he felt bad that on the session you weren't able to show your breadth of skills as a guitar player. And then he said that you would probably be able to tell the story better. Do you remember this session or what he was talking about?
Of course. Well, I had no idea Dan was going to be there. It wasn't a Dan Huff session.
Yeah.
So he was producing this artist at the time. I was playing, it was a Beatles compilation record that this guy was producing, who I also had never worked for. And the song in the morning or whatever was Blackbird, which we all know.
But just impossible to play, isn't it?
Well, like, here's the thing. I was on electric. They wanted to reimagine all these songs. But Blackbird is so iconic with just an acoustic guitar and a vocal, you know. And so he said, oh, yes, this artist is going to sing it. And her producer's going to come by and probably play the acoustic part. And I don't even remember who was playing acoustic on the session, but in walks Dan Huff. Her producer's going to come by. He didn't even say who that was. And so I was excited to meet him, first of all, because, I mean, it's Dan Huff. I mean, we've all heard him, and he's amazing. And he's also a big producer, and you want to get in the room with these people and just play. I mean, my attitude was it's funny how he puts that, because I wasn't necessarily trying to show him like what I can do. I mean, I think the best thing to do is always just play the session.
Yeah.
Whatever. If you play one note, play the hell out of it. You know, do what it needs, right? But yeah, it was kind of like this weird scenario where all I could do is just kind of like these volume swelly things that were ambiguous that, you know, you just and he came over to me at one point during the session. He goes, I think he alluded to, like, I've heard you doing some things. I know you're playing on some records, because at the time Lady A stuff was pretty big, and that was kind of the first stuff that I got going with. And he was like, yeah, man, I know that what you're doing right now is below your pay grade, but you know, it sounds great, you know.
Yeah.
He was encouraging.
And did, like, that mean something to you that he said that?
Of course, of course. Because I figured he probably knew that situation. He'd been in that situation probably himself, you know. I wanted to make an impression, but the most important impression was that I could make at that time wasn't necessarily like something that I was going to play that was going to wow him. It was more like professionality. You know, just come in here and be respectful and be the best version of what needs to happen here. And he'll see that, because he's smart and he's been there.
When you're on a session with Dan Huff, is he in any kind of position to show you anything about being a session guitar player? Or is he mostly in the producer role? Or, like, what do you take away from working with Dan Huff as a guitar player?
Well, I learn something every time I'm in the room with him, because he's... because of how good of a guitar player and accomplished musician he is, when he's speaking to you and giving you direction.
Like, what does he say?
Well, it depends on the part, but he can actually tell you, like, play it up at this fret. You know, if he wants something very specific, he can communicate exactly what he wants. And maybe you run through it and maybe the tone isn't right. Like, he can tell you exactly what to change that'll hit the way he needs to hear it in the control room. Because things are a little different in the headphones than they are in there. And Dan's got a vision for what this is going to sound like 8 steps later in final mix, right, and all this. So he's like, hey, thin that out a little bit. You know, I know it's going to sound like more thin than it should be right now, but I'm making room for other things later, you know. And I mean, just getting that mindset of like thinking further down the road than just what's happening now and making sure that what you're doing now is going to work later. And he'll come out on the floor and just say, can I grab one of your guitars? Yes, of course. Show me exactly what you're talking about. And he'll do that sometimes. But most of the time, we've worked together enough now where he kind of just wants you to do what you think first, and then we shape from there. So it's, you know, it's gotten to be more of a, I don't know, a comfortable thing, probably.
When he picks up his your guitar, or if he's like, hey, let me pick up one of these and just show you what I mean. Is that kind of a funny, like, I don't know what that's like. Like, is that weird that it's like, I don't know.
No, sometimes that's the best way to communicate. I mean, all kinds of producers are good players. And if they are, and that's how it's easier for them to just show you what they're looking for, even if they can't fully execute it, like if it's not a Dan
Just
Huff,
something, yeah.
Just something like, ah, it's something like this that I'm thinking, you know, and you see where their hands go. You go, okay, now I got exactly what you can't communicate with words through the glass sometimes.
Right.
But one time I do remember we were working one day and he was like, he picked up one of my guitars and he wasn't thinking about the fact that we had all tuned down for this song. And now I'm playing it out of the, he's like, show me what position you're playing this out of again. And I showed him and the guitar was tuned down and he was like, or something about it where he was like, you got a capo. And I handed him like this sort of newfangled capo. And I was like, here, do you know how to use this? And he was like, you don't think I know how to use a capo? You know, he was messing with me. I mean, we've gotten in this thing where we go back and forth and pick on each other.
I can picture him saying
it's a lot of fun.
Jokingly.
Yeah. I mean, you know. Yeah.
So when you first moved to town, I think one of the first gigs you had was going out with Wynonna.
Yeah.
And Tom Bukovac basically got you that gig.
Yeah.
But you say you feel like you weren't quite ready for that gig. You were a little green, I guess.
Oh, I was definitely green. And it was more to do with the music I was into at the time. I came to town, you know, kind of like trying to find my way into a lot of more Americana circles, blues circles. You know, there was more outskirts music going on than just country at the time. And then I met Tom and we've been friends for a long time now. But he was leaving that gig and I knew he was leaving that gig cause I used to hang out with him all the time and he would talk about it. I think I'm ready to jump into sessions. And I think, we would talk about that kind of stuff a lot. I just think that there were a lot of circumstances on the gig. Like it was when the Line 6 Pod first came out. I'd never played through a direct rig in my life. I was an amp guy.
Isn't it funny how I remember having a Pod and thinking, oh, this sounds so good.
Some of it did, yeah.
But now you look back and it's like, that was so premature. That was so early, that technology.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, it was just tough. It was just that learning curve of playing through a direct rig, it just didn't sound the way an amp sounds behind, you know, and it wasn't necessarily the style of music that I had the right instincts for at the time, you know, but they offered me the gig. I was so shocked. I didn't think they'd really offer it to me. I knew other people that were auditioning that were way more suited for it, you know, but yeah, I did that for about 6 months, you know.
And then what was the next step or what was your next moment?
Well, then after that, I went kind of in sort of Americana world a little bit. And then I did a tour with Leanne Womack. And then when that ended, I had been subbing some gigs for Delbert McClinton and for Todd Sharp was his guitar player at the time. And he was having me sub whenever he couldn't make it. And so he decided he was leaving that gig. And literally the end of this Leanne Womack tour I was on, it was like, what am I going to do now? And he called me like the day I was taking my gear back home and said, hey, Todd's leaving the band. I want you to be in the band. Are you interested? And I said, yes. And I literally just drove my stuff over to his bus and threw it on the bus. And then that was the next 8 years of my life until like sessions started to happen, you know.
This is that gig where there's basically no set list.
Yes.
You're making this up every night. To me, yeah. That has to be so frustrating. Isn't that a frustrating gig? Because don't you want to like hone in on what you're playing and perfect it every night and get better and better at the set? And when they keep changing the songs, you have no idea what's going to get called. Isn't that frustrating, or is that what makes it exciting?
That I can understand why. Yeah. I mean, I understand that point of view. Yes. It can be, but not to me. I thought that was the coolest thing I'd ever done. Like here he was, a guy with decades worth of music. So there's no way to rehearse it. If somebody out there wants to hear one of these old deep cuts, he's going to play it. And he's going to turn to you and go, it starts with you, and start counting it off. And you've never even heard it. You know, he might sing.
So what do you do? What do you do when he says, okay, you're starting off and you don't even know the tune? How do you fake that?
You either play something cool or you don't. He didn't require you to know it.
Yeah.
It's more about, you'll know it by the time we get to the chorus and it'll make sense. But until then, be cool. Just I don't know how to tell you, but the very first time I subbed for him, for Todd, I never even met Delbert. He called me like 3 days out. They had sent me a CD with like 10 songs on it. And I knew those. And he goes, yeah, did they send you a CD? I said, yeah. And he goes, okay, well, do you have any questions? And I go, no, not really. Not on those songs. I mean, he goes, what songs did they send you? And I started listing them off. And Delbert's, you know, he can be impatient. And he was just like, okay, it sounds like you got it. All right. Well, we'll have fun. I'll see you in Denver. And I got on the bus and he flew to the gig. So like the whole time on the bus, his whole band, who's meeting me, a lot of them for the first time, they're like, hey, you know this song, right? And I'm like, no. I mean, they were feeding me songs the whole bus ride out to Denver.
Oh, yeah.
I can't believe they didn't send you that. We play that most show. You know, well, you got to know this. Oh, you got to know this. Well, sure enough, what that means is he came on the bus 10 minutes before we went on the show, and he took one look at me, and I don't know what he thought, but he probably didn't think I was right. I was too young.
Isn't that intimidating? Like, I've been in moments like that where some guy who's so senior just looks at you on the gig, and he's like, what are you doing here, man? This is just not your scene. And hopefully you pull it off, but like, I don't know.
Well, I knew there was no way out of it, so I wasn't going to let it intimidate me. Yeah. I was just kind of... What I felt was... All the music I was super into was just going to give me the right instincts to react on stage to whatever happened. And by the way, it's happening in 10 minutes, whether I liked it or not. So it was just time to go do it. And if it was terrible, no one will remember this tomorrow. But you know, I kind of just, he looked at me, he was just like, oh my God, you don't seem old enough to know any of the music that this you need to know to play my gig. I don't know. That's what I'm assuming. And he just went, all right, man, well, we'll just have fun with it. And he walked off the bus, you know, and I'm like, okay. And sure enough, three or four songs in, he called something that nobody gave me a recording of. And he goes, well, it starts with you. What key do we do this in? And it was like, gee.
But what do you do? And then do you start playing like cowboy chords, or do you start playing like triads and inversions?
Well,
or you have to use your ear. Like, I don't understand. I don't understand how you do this.
I think one of the guys in the band just kind of said Rolling Stones.
Yeah.
Like real quick while he was counting it off. So I just thought, gee, Keith Richards, I'll just play.
So what do you play?
You know, it was like probably something just be janky and rhythmic, you know, that's what I thought to do. And I did it, and I saw him kind of turn around and look at me, and he was like, okay, this is going all right. And the band kicked in, and then we played, and I just followed. A couple guys maybe shot me numbers when the chords were changing, when you know, to get me going. And then I think the next song after that, I took a solo finally, and I remember him coming over to me at the end of my solo and grabbing my face and giving me a big kiss. And from that point on, for the next 8 years, we had a blast.
And eventually, did you learn the repertoire, or was he constantly?
Oh, yeah. But you learned it on stage.
Yeah.
I mean, there really was, we knew about usually what the first four songs were going to be, but he'd even throw curveballs at that, you know, and it just really night to night, man, he just approached it like tonight's, that was last night. It's like tonight, we don't have to play this the same every night. As long as the lyrics are there, as long as I'm singing the song and you guys are playing the right chords, I don't care how you play this song in a way. The feel is the most important.
What's the skill set you need to develop in order to be able to do that? Is it having a really good ear? Is it just knowing a lot of repertoire so that you can sense where the frame of the song is going to go?
Yeah, yeah. The ear is really important. You got to be able to hear it, right? And you know, you just get to know somebody. You just get to know, a lot can happen through body language on stage. Like what's making this guy get excited, or what's making this artist react? And when that starts happening, okay, here we are. This is remember what's going on right now, and just kind of keep it in this general ball field, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know how to explain it, but those 8 years, I became a much deeper musician, because there was so much music I was exposed to that nobody my age or any of my peer group was listening to. He was turning me on to so much stuff, and we were having so much fun going down the road, playing dice and listening to music and staying up late and just really diving into all kinds of in the cracks music.
Yeah.
And that's probably that, you know, going back to your point with Dan, you know, like, or how do you develop this range with music? It's, you have to dive in and listen to all kinds of different things you hate sometimes, and find something you like about it or why it works, even if you still hate it. You know?
I was watching these clips last night of you on the road with Bob Seger. You were on. How long were you out with him? For like over a decade.
Every couple of years. I did 3 tours with him.
Yeah,
and, one in 13, one in 15, and then a long one, his final tour in 18, 19. Yeah.
How would you? Because I was watching. I was comparing clips of you playing old time rock and roll, and I feel like you always got the solo in that song. But it was always a little different every time.
Okay.
When you're doing that kind of thing, yeah, how do you think about that solo in that song?
Okay, well, here's the story. So this is a good story, by the way. People out there who really know a lot about Bob Seger know about his manager, Punch. He co-produced a lot of those early records with Seger, and I think co-produced that song, and actually found that song for him. Seger only, that's a different gig than Delbert. Like, there is a set list. There is everything's got
to
be like
every night, probably close to
pretty much,
right?
Pretty much a couple of times he would let me have some liberty or freedom to play. That was one of them. The middle solo, you have to play like the record, because that's got to sound like the record. But there's an outro solo on live on that song that's on the record too, but that's where the fade out happens.
Right.
Well, we played it longer than the record. So whenever his manager came out to see us, Bob would just say, at that point, play whatever you want, as long as it's in the style of something rock and roll. Like, you know, and great. So when Punch would come out to the gigs, I'd be walking off stage and walk into the dressing room, and he'd find me and he'd go, "Hey, I got to talk to you." And I'm like, "Okay, what's up?" And I always knew what he was going to, and it was that it bugged him that I would go off and play other things than what, I don't know what he thought he wanted to hear, but he'd go, "It's like you're playing the solo and then I don't even know what song you're playing anymore." You know, he's like, "You got to play it like the record." And we had this thing going for every tour. I'd go, "Well, get me a copy of what happens after the record fades out.
After the fade out.
Because here's what's happening. We go longer than the record. And there's no reference for that. So if you have a recording of that extra eight bars
like,
or whatever.
I will play whatever you want me to play.
Yeah, exactly.
And just tell me what it is. By the way,
just so you know, Punch, Bob told me this is one of these moments where you can do what you want.
Yeah, yeah.
And he'd go, Bob said that? I'm like, yeah. And then he was like, oh, okay. Well, if Bob says it's okay, it's okay. But the next show, he'd say the same thing. And finally, I'd have to explain the whole thing over. We play this longer than the record. I don't know what you want me to get me a recording. And he'd go, ah, okay. And then the next night, you know, because he would come out for a couple of shows at a time. And then the next night, I'd do whatever I wanted the next night. And he would come up to me and go, you're doing a great job, kid. Just walk away.
What are the licks you need for that solo? Or like,
oh man, I can't remember. But
what's the style of it? Like, well, when you're kind of freaking out at the end, or you're just playing the outro part?
I didn't always. This is probably more what he was talking about. You know, you kind of stick somewhere close to Chuck Berry land.
Yeah.
That's just that song. But yeah, I mean, it's just all that. You know, like. You know, just, you know, typical rock and roll. Don't get too crazy. I think a couple times if I knew he wasn't around, I might do a little something, you know, in there.
Something a little spicy.
Yeah. But, you know, in his mind, this music had to be, it was iconic music. So I get both points. It does have to sound like Bob Seger and the Silver Bullet Band on the record, you know.
Yeah.
So, but Bob was always encouraging it to be like, go, you know, and then
how do you play rhythm on that song? Do you play exactly what's on the
record
in that rhythm part where you're doing that, what, that like power chord thing?
It's just literally Chuck Berry.
It's that. Yeah, that's it.
You know,
yeah,
that's what it is.
Yeah, exactly.
Know? Yeah.
So how did you get into the session scene from the road? And you say that you never even really desired to be a session player. When you moved to town?
Well, when I moved to town, it was still very, a much smaller group of people playing on the records, you know, and I don't know. I didn't really know what it meant to be a session player. I knew about guys that played sessions, but I don't know. I just didn't think that I could hear myself on Nashville records. You know, what was happening at the time was all Brent Mason. That was a lot of it anyway. And
was it too much? Was it like, oh my God, there's another Brent Mason lick on the radio? He's the greatest ever, but.
No, he's one of the most prolific guys in that style. He kind of took that thing to a very commercial next level and made it cool to have that kind of, I always thought he was, and still do think he's one of the greatest that's ever lived. And has a voice, you know. I don't know. But I knew that I didn't really play that way. I have a version of things like that, but that's not me, and that's where music was. So I just kind of leaned into all the other pockets in town, like you know, I was excited by like things like Buddy Miller or guitar playing like Richard Bennett or things that would be on Steve Earle records or. Eddie Shaver was great. There were all these other Americana alt country things that were happening. I kind of identified more with that because it felt like it was closer to like blues kind of stuff and you know, Delbert and all that. So I don't know. I just didn't see myself being a desired thing to be on a Nashville record. But tastes change and the styles definitely changed and things started opening up. And after I kind of had the Delbert gig for a good while, people just started asking me to do sessions. And since they were asking, I showed up. There was no pressure. I didn't feel like it was a career move.
What do you think gets you called? Is it intonation and touch? And like, why did people think? Because I feel like there's tons of great players that don't get called for sessions.
Oh yeah.
So like, what do you think it is that people were identifying in you that they started calling you?
Well, all those things you mentioned, I think you just gotta have. You have to have that, and it's assumed that you know. And there's tons. You don't move to town and not have that.
Yeah.
I think, you know, kind of. Yeah. I think. I can't speak for other people, but I can say that I have a I think my strong suit is coming up with hooks and being able to find different sounds that work together. And I mean, you know, just looking for things to do that are exciting, and knowing when that happens. I don't know. I think maybe I just listen to a bunch of different music that your average session player in Nashville might not be as steeped in. They're steeped in all the stuff I don't mean that to sound weird or
just different stuff.
Just different stuff. And then after I played on a few big songs, it just kind of got acceptable.
So when you played Need You Now,
yeah.
When you play on that really big hit,
yeah.
Did they ask for that slide part that you played, or how did that get on the record?
No. Okay. Well, Paul Worley, when he was working with that band, we did a lot of pre-production rehearsals. So we would kind of really experiment with those songs outside of the studio. Like we rent
a room. How often do you do that nowadays?
Never.
And was it common back then, or no. was it weird to do that?
No, Paul wanted to do that because I think the goal with those records was to sound like a band, not like a bunch of session musicians, even though we crafted those parts and tones like you would if you were a session player. But no, when we worked on that song in pre-production rehearsals, I remember, I don't know what made me, I just thought a George Harrison-esque slide part would be cool. And then I just started doing it, and nobody really said anything. And I'll be honest, I was a little offended because I thought the shit I was doing was pretty fucking cool. But no, they were worried. They were concentrated on other elements at that point. They weren't necessarily. But I do remember when we finally laid down, okay, let's record this rehearsal version. So when we get in the studio in a couple weeks, we kind of have this reference as a starting point. And I do remember. At that point, I think Paul kind of acknowledged that what I was doing, he was digging.
So the part that you thought was really fucking cool was that like that slide part on the record.
Yeah.
Is that the only thing you play on it? Is the slide guitar, or
no,
are you doing other guitars?
I mean, there's other rhythm stuff in there that I'm doing too. I played regular guitar with the slide on my hand the whole time. It is all one take, one like going from playing regular guitar to slide. Because he wanted it organic like that. He didn't, you know, those records sound more expensive than they actually are. I mean, they're, you know.
What do you mean by that?
Well, he wanted a performance.
Right. Okay.
He didn't want 8 guitars, you know. He wanted it. And then it was me and Slim on guitar, their guitar player. And I don't know. There's a lot of the rhythm parts. I'd have to review it again to tell you specifically what's Slim and what's me. But no, I played the whole thing rhythm until the slide needed to happen, and then I would just jump to the slide and do the slide parts. You know, yeah.
And now some guy in their band right now has to play the slide forever. Because you put that part. Didn't you do a session though at one point where somebody was like, you know what I really need? I really need something to sound like the slide guitar part on Need You Now.
Yeah.
Can you do something like that?
Yes.
Didn't that happen to you shortly afterwards?
Yeah. Well, the song was a huge hit at this point. It was number one, definitely. And it'd been out and everybody was paying attention to that. And a lot of people still didn't know that it was me. But because I was still kind of a new face in the scene and in the studio. I was working for somebody that I don't even remember who it was, because I don't think I ever saw him again. But it was a female artist, and she came out. I remember her coming out with her laptop, and I was, you know, playing the guitar I played on it, which was my old 355, Gibson 355. I mean, it was the exact same rig. Same thing. And the song I could tell in there sounded very Lady A-ish. They were shooting for that sound. And I thought, okay, well, I'm just going to grab what made those tones. And she came out and like played me myself, you know. It's like, hey, can you, it's something cool like this. I mean, we don't want to rip this off, obviously, but like do something like this. And I was like, you mean this? Like, is that, you know? And she was like, yeah, that's it right there. And I was like, cool.
Yeah.
It, you know,
How do you market yourself as a session guitar player in a world where I feel like it's so uncool to do so, but now you're like the guy who just played this mega hit and nobody knows it? Isn't that like a huge problem if you're trying to make a living at this thing?
It felt like it.
So what happened? Or like, how do you get through that?
I mean, it was before social media. It was before all the things that, like, everybody knows what everybody's doing before it even comes out now. And if you're clued into the scene around here, you see session players posting or getting tagged in posts from a session today on music that might not even come out ever or 6 months from now or whatever. So that kind of marketing is happening. Whereas back then it just had to be word of mouth. People just heard. I mean, you know, I know that Paul Worley just started using me on anything he was doing, or a lot of it that he was doing at that time. And so I was meeting a lot of other established players that were coming to find out, oh, that's you on that. Or, oh, that's cool. I heard that on the radio and I really dug it. And I didn't know who played on it, you know. Or they assumed it was one of the more established guys or something, you know.
How'd you get into the Luke Combs camp?
Well, Chip Matthews and Jonathan Singleton produced that stuff that I played on. When they started taking over the production for him, I'd worked a lot for Singleton over the years. And I go way back with Chip Matthews and we have a blast together. So I don't know. They just were shaking things up. And as things happen, I mean, you know, you play on a lot of these things for an artist and you're, you know, typically after about the third record with the same band or fourth record, somewhere in that area, they maybe change producer. And that's just how that happened. I knew Singleton pretty good and Chip Matthews and I'd been around Luke some, you know. I don't know if he was aware of it or not, you know, but that's how that happened.
So how'd you play on Fast Car? Because that's you playing, you and who else is on that?
It's me and Derek Wells.
You and Derek Wells. Yeah. So when they bring that in, do they say, all right, guys, we're going to do Fast Car today? And you go, oh, the Tracy Chapman song?
Yeah.
And then, like, do you remember, was there anything notable about how it was arranged that day or how it came together?
No, you know, first of all, I always loved that song when it came out. It's such a great song. It was pretty straight ahead, really. It leaned on the acoustic pretty hard. So in the electric department, we just stayed out of the way and kind of played the chords together. I think all the verses are in there. I don't even think they edited out the verses.
Yeah.
I don't know. I can't remember.
I think it's the full thing.
We might've contemplated that, but I was surprised to see how many verses there were and how long the song actually was and how fast the tempo was. We
really?
Probably changed the tempo a little.
Yeah.
Or something. Yeah. When you haven't heard something for several, you know, 20 years or something, and then you hear it again, even if it's something you used to listen to a lot has happened since then, and you
hear it.
And you go, sometimes you go, wow, it's faster than I remember it. Or wow, it's a really long song. How was that a hit?
So you start, because it feels to me like most of the guitars are on it are almost like pads or
support.
Just textures.
Yeah.
So how do you do that? Do you dial in like a sound with your board where you go, that's a nice kind of reverb delay sound?
Yeah.
And then you start figuring, and are you playing like bar chords on it? Or like, how do you come up with what you're going to do on that song?
Well, just dialing up some spacious sounds and just kind of letting long notes ring out. That's not really a bar chord song, you know, it's more of a singer songwriter vibe. So this isn't going to be that song exactly, but you know. You know, it just something with trails, and you just kind of let those notes ring out. Maybe some modulation on the delay or something that just gives it some motion, even when you're just hanging things out there, you know. And you might do a little bend with the tele neck or something, you know. Or you know, I was probably playing a Strat that had a bar or something, you know.
How do you program delays? Because you say that you like to back the BPM off a little bit.
Well, it depends on the song. If it's a hard gridded song with a loop, now we don't play a bunch with loops. We've gotten away from that a little bit, but in the era a few years back, when you're on the grid with a loop, you don't get away with not having the exact BPM as easily. So in those instances, I'll just go straight to the BPM. But without it, I just dial them back a little bit because they smear a little better into the track. And if delay is an important part to your sound, as long as it's not the like a rhythmic delay that has to drive the rhythm,
like the edge or something.
If it's not doing that, then it's just something that's back there that's swirling around. So I like, you know, the delay time is less important, is what I'm trying to say. You know, you just get a good tone going where it doesn't muddy up any melodic content you want to do. It's tricky. You have to, you know, dial the mix down and maybe the repeats up more, or vice versa. You figure it out as the track's going.
What do you use? You've got Strymon on the board for your delays right now, it looks like.
Yeah. So I've got, this is my, if I don't have cartage and I'm walking into a session bringing all my own
gear.
We had
no cartage for this interview.
Yeah.
So he walked in with this. That was the tell.
Yeah. This is like when Rocky had to go back to the old gym
exactly.
to get tough again.
Yes.
So I love the Strymon Volante delay. That sounds really good to me. And I've got a little bit of delay in the line 6 M9 going too. So sometimes getting two delays that are doing two different things can help fill out the sound and the trails, I guess, and they mod differently. You know, I don't know. It's all, at this point, it's all autopilot. I don't think about it as much. I just, that sounds cool. Leave it until it's not.
Yeah. Is there a part on a song that you feel is like something on the radio that you just love that you played on that people might not even realize you played on? Is there something that you think is just a really great part that you played?
Yeah. I mean, well, I am actually pretty proud of a lot of stuff, in recent years. But one that keeps coming back to me lately is all the Lainey Wilson stuff, in particular, the slide solo on Heart Like a Truck.
Yeah.
I love that just fell out and then we harmonized it, and you know, and it just became this, like, when I finally heard that on the radio, I loved it, you know. The other song of hers is Watermelon Moonshine, like those.
What did you play
bendy
on Watermelon Moonshine?
I don't remember the exact guitars, but I have a feeling on both those songs, most of the parts on those songs that I played and the lead parts and solos are all, this black Les Paul, 68 Les Paul Custom.
Yeah.
I tend to play that guitar a lot over at Jay's. These two guitars, like with Jay Joyce, a lot of those Lainey things are these two guitars, I think.
Can you give us like a lick or something? Is there a blues lick that you always love that you find yourself coming to?
Oh man,
is there a rock lick? Is there something, is there a lick that every session guy in Nashville should have in their bag?
Let's see here.
On the spot here, Rob.
Yeah. It's funny. I've become so drummer dependent when it comes to these kind of things.
I totally get that.
Is
there a turnaround lick?
Okay. I can't think of something that's going to come up on a session necessarily.
Yeah.
But it's more about the attitude of a very stock thing. Like pretend you're just doing the most basic blues thing in the world that every guitar player, beginner, knows. Like just even something like... I mean, that's basic shit, right?
Yeah.
If somebody does that in Guitar Center, just, you know, on their lunch break from their job, they're probably not going to execute it in a way that's inspiring. But
You just made it sound good. How do you do that?
Well, I, you know, it's just messing around and just messing around with it and going deeper with it, trying to make something that sounds so stock and easy. You've probably had this experience. I know I have, where I hear somebody play something so simple and I think, oh, I can do that. And then when you do it, you can't figure out why it's not the same.
Yeah.
That happens. I watch that happen. A lot of people have me show them something, or they'll go, oh, it's this. Or I go somewhere and hear somebody play something I played on a record, and they're missing some element.
I feel this way with all you session guys, that you do this simple shit that it's like, I can't do that. Even though I can, I can't.
It's not about the, at that point, it's not about the notes anymore. It's about the personality behind it, you know? And I don't know how to put that into words exactly, but yeah, it's about, I care a whole lot less about things being in tune than other people do. When it comes to single note stuff, I always love that about players like Jeff Beck or Clapton, some of the early stuff he did with Mayall or Cream. The coolest thing isn't the stock lick, it's the way they did it. It's, you know, just like, you know, like just being able to just get, you know, making beautiful things sound ugly in a way, you know. I don't know.
What was the thing? Were you gonna say something about that lick? You played that lick and you were like, that sounds simple, or was the point to put the attitude in it, or was there something else?
Yeah, I mean, you know, okay, I'm trying to remember, like, you know, like you just want to feel it. You just there's just got to be some, I like when it's just something very simple, very usual, but something ugly about it, something that grabs you by the lapels and
yeah,
makes you want to fight.
You did this video breaking down a Kenny Chesney song that okay. You did with Kenny Greenberg, and you were demonstrating on that song how you were going between E and an A chord, but you were muting on the E chord, you're muting the G string to get the to make it an E5, and then on the A chord, you're muting the B string to make it an A5. Yeah. That's such a great session trick,
exactly.
Right? Any other tricks like that that you love on, like, any chords that we've been playing our whole life that we can just modify a little bit? I'm putting you on the spot here.
Yeah, no, that's
anything
okay.
like that.
Yeah, well, yes. Anytime.
Demonstrate that okay. chord right there.
Okay,
yeah, yeah.
Like, yeah. Like it's an E major chord,
yeah,
because somebody else is playing a major note,
right.
Whether it's the acoustic guitar or keyboards or some, that's coming from somewhere. Guitar, that's just not cool.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, in that context. So you remove the third, the major third, and then all of a sudden it's more
so much,
muscular.
Yes. Right.
And you know, yeah, inside of a band context where you're competing with other frequencies and all that, start removing chords. I thought about that because B3 players, I started asking somebody, it was this great session musician named John Hobbs, how do you always know, everything you play on the B3 sounds so, it fits every time. And Mike Rojas is this way. Everybody's this way. A lot of people are this way. But those are the two guys that I really clued into, like, oh, they're not playing. They're playing two notes.
Yeah.
The most important notes, you know, and that comes back to, like, you know, great old jazz players, you know, that would just be comping and just playing two notes, you know. You know, you know
that's
what those chords are.
Yeah.
But you know, it's like, yeah, I just started thinking about simplifying my voicings and because some of the stuff you're going to have to double and tuning, you know, I said I don't care about tuning. I care about tuning when
that
you're
third rings out and it's out of tune. That's not good.
That's not the cool kind of ugly I'm talking about.
Yeah.
You know,
wait, so what other voicings? Are there any other voicings that kind of tap into that mentality?
You know,
that you really like?
Yeah. I mean, you like a lot of things like, let's say, the Lainey Wilson song, Things a Man Ought to Know, like I don't remember the exact part, but You know, those kind of like Curtis Mayfield voicings, yeah. Those work in softer parts. So that's just those four strings. And you can remove the bass note because somebody bass is going to play that. So now you're down to two notes. You just do that move and get off that string. You know, it's about taking away, depressing a button instead of pressing a button.
Yeah, right, right. You know? Yeah.
Yeah.
What's the Les Paul? Should we break the Les Paul? Wait. This guitar, really quickly.
Yeah.
This was your dad's guitar.
Yeah.
That you saw, he brought it home when, I mean, you should tell the story, but
yeah.
Tell the story because it's such a great story.
Yeah. So I was probably about 10 years old and he had been down here making a record and he went to Gruen Guitars and bought a 65 Strat and this guitar, which is a 55 Tele. And neither of them are, the Strat is more straight than this. This body's been refined. Everything else is original, but as far as I know. He just came home and he loved this guitar and he was like, you got to check this guitar out. And so I came out and the case was laying on the floor and opened up the case. And I didn't know anything about guitars. I was like, that was right when I was really starting to even care and play a guitar. But something about this guitar, when I saw it, I knew right away, like that's a cool guitar.
Yeah.
You know, it's probably all the wear on the fret, on the
it had all that when he brought it home.
Most of it. It was a played guitar and it just looked cool.
So all the wear on that was like that when you got the guitar.
Most of it
when he brought it home,
it was definitely worn. I probably have worn more of it off. Yeah, it just looked like a guitar I wanted to play, and I didn't know what kind of guitar it was. I didn't know anything about it. I just knew it was cool, and I took it to my room and started playing it, and then you know, it just felt like a great guitar, you know. And his Strat fell that way too, you know, but he made a bigger deal out of this guitar. So I thought it was cooler than the Strat. They're both really cool.
Yeah.
It turns out.
And then, but then somehow the guitar got lost. And then I think Paul Worley had it, right?
Yeah. Well, he was working with Paul. Paul was producing his band, McGuffey Lane, back in the 80s. They were signed to Atco Records and they were down here making records with Paul. Yeah, at some point, my dad, I don't know, he sold the guitar to Paul. I don't know the circumstances because he didn't ask me if he could.
Yeah, right.
You know, and I didn't know that.
Family heirloom, Dad. What are you doing?
Right.
You got to keep that.
You got to keep in mind, too, these weren't vintage. They weren't valuable then. I think this was like he probably paid $1,000 for this, you know, and Paul bought it probably for what something around that from him. But anyway, the guitar was gone. When my dad passed away, I didn't know what happened to it. I got the Strat and a cool acoustic and maybe a couple of other things that he had that were cool. But this guitar wasn't there. And when I moved to town, I just started asking people that knew my dad at the time, like, did you ever see this Tele? You know, and somebody, a mutual friend of Paul's and mine, said, yeah, I think Paul bought a Tele off your dad. It's probably that Tele. And I'm thinking it has to be. My dad didn't have another
Tele. You get that kind of like I feel like I learned tunes like that by like Reverend Gary Davis and like a lot of like old blues guys. Like, is that where you picked up that sort of, what is that? I always confuse the like Piedmont style of playing versus other styles of like blues.
Yeah. I mean, there's all those guys, but I feel like I kind of also, those guys didn't hear things like Creedence Clearwater Revival.
It's kind of that thing too, right?
Swampy music. It's just from a, you know, there's, I mean, you know, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
It's a mix of all kinds of things to me.
Okay. You know? That's the 50. It's a 55?
55. Yeah.
Tele. Okay. Now we're going to move to the 68.
Okay.
Les Paul really quickly.
Yeah.
Here. What's the story with this? This one was not in the rig rundown, was it?
Well,
I don't think it was. It
no, it wasn't.
It wasn't. This is an exclusive.
This is an exclusive.
Take that, Premier Guitar. Yeah. No, I'm kidding.
Yeah, those guys are terrible. No,
no, we love those guys.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that was fun to do. Okay, so this guitar I thought was going to be there, and this happens to me sometimes. I'll get when I don't have time to like change strings for a session or something like that, and I notice that a guitar is kind of needing that, but I don't have time, I'll just grab another Les Paul or another.
That's right.
Strat.
You said that. You said that in the video actually, and you had like a burst, like a Rick Nielsen.
Yeah.
Guitar in that video. Yeah.
Which is also a great guitar. It just that day I totally undid the zipper on the gig bag and pulled, and I was like, oh shit, I thought I threw the custom in here, but you know, just not here. Yeah. So you just play something different.
Is this a two piece body or a one piece? When does it go to the pancake bodies with Gibson?
This is
it looks like a one piece.
I was told it was a one piece when I bought it.
Yeah.
Now the difference though is that the 68s have the maple cap.
Yes.
Whereas the original customs are all mahogany.
Right.
So they have the maple top. Okay, somebody out there might go, no, they don't.
Yeah,
you know,
someone's gonna
do
that.
Know,
yeah.
You know,
we're just guessing here.
But the story on this is I'd just gotten off the road with Seeger on one of those tours, and I wasn't looking for anything. I just walked into Carter, and something about this guitar, just, you know how sometimes you see that one on the wall and you just go, that looks like that's a good guitar. And I just wanted to play it, you know, and of course in 5 minutes, 30 seconds, you know, it's a really good one.
It got me.
I walked out of there with it. I made him an offer and it was close enough to, it was a consignment. So they called whoever they had to call and they came back in and said, yeah, they took it. So now I had to buy it.
That's always what's scary about doing that. Like you're like, shit, if they do it, then I got to buy it.
Yeah. So yeah, it's kind of, but it's, I use this guitar a lot. It's of all the Les Pauls I have, it's my favorite. It's probably just because, old guitars, they have a little something, not always better. Cause there's other things that some of the newer Les Pauls I have, like actually record a little bit better in certain circumstances, but this one has things those won't do. You know, it just has certain tones that, you know, just aging does, I think. Wood and pickups get weird after a while.
Yeah.
Or, you know.
Play this one a little bit. What does this one sound like?
Let's see. Like, so that's bridge pickup, and that does, you know, you can,
that's
get,
kind
you can
of
do whatever.
Keith Richards-y sounding. Yeah.
I like that era when Keith Richards is pictured playing Les Paul custom a lot.
Yeah.
You know, it's a three pickup, but I don't know. And then, it's just got a really good sound to it. I mean, the neck pickup does great, that sort of R&B style stuff that I was just doing. And then the bridge pickup bites, you know, it's just great Les Paul, you know.
It's hard to find good Les. It's hard to find good all these instruments.
It is. But man, we live in such a great time. I mean, I as much as I am a vintage guitar enthusiast, I do think that all the, you know, Fender and Gibson are really making things that can compete with those instruments at times. Not every one of them, but not all these were great either.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, they're right, all right over the place. But if you just keep playing enough of them, you'll find the one, you know.
We're wrapping up here with Rob.
Hey.
Rob, thanks so much for taking
the
time.
Thank you, Zach. I love your show.
Dude,
I watch
thank
it.
Thank you so much. By the way, Rob has some solo music
yes
out. You put out a couple singles last year that were
yeah
awesome.
Thank you. Thank you. I put out a few, and I'm getting and gearing up for more. There's a bunch of stuff recorded, and I'm finally putting it out.
I thought Right Back to You was awesome.
Thank you.
They're killer. What are you doing? Are you going to go out and are you going to play these ever? I mean, you probably... Didn't you do something at the Underdog or something?
Yeah, I've done some gigs at the Underdog. I've played over at Eastside Bowl here recently a few times. I'm starting to play out with my band here there. It's hard to fit in because I stay busy in the session world, and the guys in my band are session players. I got Jerry Rowe on drums, like one of the busiest drummers out there.
Yeah.
Steve Mackey on bass. We're all busy, so it's hard to find time to do a gig. But we're committed to doing it, and these guys are my... you know, friends from forever ago, and we're starting to play out some. So
are session guitar players going to be a dying breed, or do you see like another generation coming up,
man,
that can take it over?
There are so many great players coming up all the time that I see.
Is there going to be an industry for it?
That's a good question. I think about that more for them. Because I mean, I've had a pretty long career at this point. I think by the point that it's really impacting us in a way that we don't know yet, I don't see that coming very soon. But let's face it, I mean, technology's getting so good, and we know about things like AI. I don't know where they're going, but I can guarantee this: the people at the top never want to pay anybody for anything. So if they can use something that they don't have to pay to make great music and it sell and it that goes out there and does what they need, they don't need us. So I don't know where that leaves us, you know. But I just don't know that that's realistic or not. People, whether they know it or not, react more still to man-made music than computer-made music for the long haul, in my opinion. We're still listening to all the records we were listening to that are 60 years old.
Yeah.
A lot. I don't know.
You said in the Rig Rundown video that you don't use an amp switcher because the time it takes to switch amps with a cable gives you a minute to think about what you're going to play. Did you say that in jest, or is that really your thought process? You could easily have an amp switcher if you wanted one.
Yeah.
Why not have one?
Well, I probably should have one, but it was half in jest and half serious because, man, I don't think you should sit there in the chair and slave away the whole time. You can get worn down. So even having that just 30-second standing up. Out of the chair and
is a good thing.
As soon as I sit back down, my mind's a little more clear, and I'm ready to breathe fresh air into the next part. Session players, we talk about little things like that all the time.
Is there another one that you can think of that that's a good session trick that everyone should be doing?
Yeah, like for instance, when somebody says something like, okay, like you're working on a solo, and you play something that you really like, but they don't like it in there, but they don't know what they want. Okay, how to handle that if you are funny, like if they say I don't really dig that, you know, and you say, well, I don't dig your fucking face. I'm gonna give you
Does
a playlist on your
you?
Face. With certain people, because then they laugh and it lightens the mood a little bit, and everybody's not so serious for just 5 seconds, and then we go back at it, and maybe I play almost the same exact thing, but I change a couple notes about it, because I mean, to me, it's like it's really not that they don't sometimes they don't like it, and you're just doing the wrong thing, but that's evident, and you just try something completely different. But when you know you're onto something that they just need to hear again, it's more about the familiarity.
So will they ever say, I don't like that, play something else? And do you ever play the same thing and they go, that's it?
I have done that a couple times and that's worked, but that generally doesn't go. They're smarter than that. But yeah, no, a lot of times something that you can do, and I don't advise this, and they're usually too smart for this, is like, okay, totally abandon that idea. And then the next thing you're going to play just isn't as spontaneous. And then you try a couple things and you go, man, can we just listen to that first one again? And then when they hear it again, they hear how inspired you were. And then they like it because now we've tried some other things that they maybe just, man, that your instincts were right and I wasn't caught up to you. Sometimes right. The producer isn't thinking about it like you are and you're in it deeper in that moment. And sometimes they just need to, they need a break too and hear something else. And then when they come back to that first thing you did, oftentimes that ends up being
The one. How important is your EQ pedal and how do you use it on sessions?
That is hugely important. I used to get weird sounds, drastic EQ moves, like only mids all the way up or everything else way all the way off. Or sometimes I use it as a, you know, the boost for like when you have 90% of your sound is working, but if you find you're turning yourself up in the headphone box more to hear yourself, that means there's frequencies that aren't working. That doesn't mean you need to be louder in your phones. So then I start, okay, why can't I hear myself? It's usually somewhere in the low end. Start carving out low end, or low mids, or sometimes doing counterintuitive moves like drastically boosting a low mid frequency and taking a bass frequency away. I use it to help me if I'm not reaching for that and I'm using this to hear myself better, I'm probably getting a better tone for that song in that mix.
How do you dial it in? Like, do you identify the frequency in your head and then you find it, or do you just kind of start moving the levers until the tone pops out?
Yeah, I used to just blind, like somebody blind, like what's going to work? I don't know. But you know, your ear develops over time and even if I don't know the exact frequency that needs to come up, I know whether it's a high, mid or low frequency. And so I can just kind of go, okay, that needs to be better. Maybe it's that I'm playing a Strat that really doesn't push any mids. And so I'll just bump some mids on that guitar for that part, you know, or something. You know?
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Rob, take us home with something. Give us a little noodle to take us out of here on the 68 Les Paul. One little bend, you were bending the major third or the minor third into the major third a little bit on that.
Yeah, I kind of screwed it.
Yeah.
I didn't do it well.
No, it sounded great. That's always a great move.
I meant
right?
to do that. Yeah. Like, you know,
that's always a great move, right? That's
always is a good move to me.
That's always a good move. Yeah. We're wrapping up here with Rob McNally, 4-time ACM Guitar Player of the Year.
Yeah.
Dude, thanks for taking the time and coming in.
Yeah, thank you for
having
me.
We'll do it again.
Zach, anytime.
Great to see you, brother.